Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments, historical what ifs.
Today, we're tackling a scenario that is just immense in its implications. The title of our episode is The Unseen Conquest, The Inca Empire Without Pizarro.
And that's the central question, isn't it? What if that one man, Francisco Pizarro, and his small band of conquistadors had never arrived? For me, as a storyteller, this is one of history's most compelling narratives. You have this vast, sophisticated empire, the Tahuantinsuyu, the realm of the four parts, brought to its knees by fewer than 200 men. It's a story that feels almost unbelievable. I've always been captivated by the idea of removing that single pivotal moment and seeing what story unfolds instead.
I completely agree. My fascination comes from a slightly different angle. The Inca Empire was so unique, almost alien to a European model of civilization. It functioned largely without money, without markets in the way we understand them. It was built on this incredible system of reciprocity and labor obligation. It's a completely different way of organizing millions of people. The thought of what that system could have become, how it might have evolved on its own terms, is just intellectually thrilling.
Exactly. We're not just talking about a different political map. We're talking about a fundamentally different path for human development in an entire hemisphere. So, the question we're posing today is a big one. If the devastating European conquest is erased from the timeline, what happens to this incredible civilization?
Does it continue its expansion and become a kind of superpower, an Andean Rome? Or were there internal fractures, like the civil war Pizarro exploited, that would have led to its downfall anyway? Join us as we strip away the known history and try to imagine a world where the Inca Empire was left to forge its own destiny.
And you touched on something crucial there, the internal fractures. Pizarro was an opportunist, yes, but he walked into a situation that was already volatile. The civil war between Huascar and Atahualpa was the main event, but the empire itself was built on a very rigid social structure. It wasn't necessarily a happy union of peoples.
Right. It was a conquest state, and that rigidity is expressed in some, well, pretty visceral ways. I was reading about the practice of cranial deformation for the nobility.
Oh, it's incredible. They would bind the heads of infants to physically mark them out as different, to give them this elongated conical skull. It's a permanent, unchangeable sign of status. You are literally shaped for leadership from birth.
Wow. I mean, we talk about blue blood, but that is on another level entirely. It's a physical manifestation of a divine mandate, isn't it? It connects directly to the Sapa Inca himself, being seen as a living god, the son of Inti, the sun god.
Precisely. His right to rule, his mission to conquer, it all stems from this holy ancestry. So when you have the nobility physically altering their bodies to reflect that special status, it reinforces the entire cosmic and political order. It's not just politics, it's theology.
And what a theology! It wasn't just about the sun. You look at their pantheon, and it's this beautiful, complex reflection of the world they lived in. You have Pachamama, the earth mother, Apu Ilapu, the rain god. Everything vital to survival has a divine presence.
It's a world where the sacred and the mundane are completely interwoven. They had a rainbow god, Quichi, linked to fertility, a goddess for the sea, Pachamama. It's so deeply tied to the land, to the vertical archipelago we talked about, where you have the coast, the mountains, the jungle. Their gods inhabited every single ecological niche.
But that interwovenness has a darker side. A much darker side. We can't talk about their religion without acknowledging the role of human sacrifice.
No, you can't. It's central to it. When the Sapa Inca, Huayna Capac, died, they sacrificed something like 4,000 attendants, officials, and concubines to accompany him into the next world.
4,000? That's staggering. It's hard to reconcile that with the idea of a society built on reciprocity and communal work.
It is. And even more challenging is the practice of capacocha.
Yeah. How did that work? It wasn't just random, was it?
No, it was highly ritualized. It was reserved for the most important moments. The death of an emperor, a famine, a great victory. They would choose perfect, unblemished children from across the empire, treat them like royalty for a time, and then take them to these high mountain peaks and leave them as offerings. The idea was that they were the purest possible messengers to the gods.
Messengers. That's a chilling way to put it. So in our what-if scenario, without the Spanish, this practice would have continued. It wasn't a sign of decline. It was a core function of the state and their worldview.
A core function. It was about maintaining cosmic balance, the Pacha. Their world was divided into three levels, right? The upper world of the gods, our earthly world, and the underworld. Sacrifice was a way of mediating between these realms, of paying a debt to the gods to keep the universe in order.
So, power in the Inca Empire wasn't just about roads and armies. It was about the ability to command the ultimate price from your subjects, to maintain the cosmos itself. That's a level of control that's almost impossible for us to comprehend.
And that's the thing, isn't it? It's a power that's not just political, it's metaphysical. But to wield that kind of metaphysical power, you need an incredibly sophisticated physical system to back it up. You can't just declare cosmic balance. You have to manage it, on the ground, in every village.
Right. It's one thing to command a sacrifice from a mountaintop. But how do you command a tax levy of potatoes from a valley 500 miles away? Especially when you don't use money.
Exactly. And the answer is just genius. It's the quipu, the knotted strings. We think of it as an accounting tool, and it was, but it was so much more. It was their writing system, their database, their spreadsheet, all rolled into one.
It's mind-boggling. You have these specialists, the Quipuca Mayox, who could read these complex arrangements of knots and colors. They could tell you how many llamas were in a certain province, the grain stores, the census data.
The census data, down to the individual. They knew who was of age to work, who was of age to serve in the army. This wasn't a vague generalized system. This was granular data management on a massive scale. It was the operating system of the entire empire.
So, in our scenario, without the Spanish, you'd see the evolution of this three-dimensional data system. Would it have evolved into a more abstract form of writing? I mean, some researchers believe they were already encoding stories and histories in them, not just numbers.
Oh, I think it absolutely would have. Because information is power, but information is useless if it can't move. And that's the other half of the equation, the Capac Nan.
The Great Inca Road. 25,000 miles of it, right? Over some of the most brutal terrain on the planet.
Brutal. And it wasn't just a path, it was a network, a nervous system. And along this network, you had the Chaskis, the relay runners.
The imperial messengers. And they were, what? They could get a message from Cusco to Quito over 1,000 miles in under a week?
Faster than a horse could travel the same distance in Europe at the time. A quipu with new orders could be dispatched from the capital, passed from runner to runner, and a governor hundreds of miles away would have it in his hands in days.
So you have this This incredible combination. A sophisticated data storage system in the Qipu, and a high-speed data transfer system in the Chaskis and the Rhodes. It's, wow, but it also sounds terrifyingly efficient. A totalitarian dream in a way. There's no hiding from the state, is there?
There really isn't. The state knew who you were, what you owed, and where you were. But the flip side of that obligation was the state's obligation to you. This wasn't just about extraction. The state maintained massive storehouses, the kulkas, filled with food and textiles. If your region suffered a drought or a crop failure, the state would open the storehouses and provide for you.
So it's a cradle-to-grave social contract. You give your labor, the mita, and in return, you get security. No one starves in the Tawantinsuyu, Suyu, in theory.
In theory. It's a system built on reciprocity, not commerce. There's no room for a merchant class, no way to accumulate personal wealth in the way we understand it. Your wealth is in your relationships, your community standing, and the state's provision.
But does that stifle ambition? Does it stifle innovation? If your life is essentially planned out for you by a divine emperor whose accountants track you on knotted strings, where does the individual fit in? I wonder if, without an external shock like Pizarro, that system would have eventually buckled under its own rigidity.
That is the fundamental question, and I think we tend to view it through our own lens of individualistic, capitalist ambition. We see a system without a merchant class, without a path to personal riches, and we assume it must be stagnant. But I don't think that's right. The innovation was communal. It was state-driven. You don't build 25,000 miles of road over the Andes or develop freeze-drying for potatoes without immense, focused, collective innovation.
Okay, so the innovation is there, but it's directed from the top down. The Sapa Inca needs a new road. The state innovates a way to build it. But does that allow for disruptive ideas? Could a brilliant farmer in a far-flung province develop a new crop and become wealthy? No, that wasn't in the OS.
No, it wasn't. But the system was buckling. Or at least, it was being tested from within. The civil war between Huascar and Atahualpa, that's the ultimate stress test. It wasn't just two brothers fighting. It was a fight for the soul of the empire. Huascar represented the old guard, the Cusco nobility. Atahualpa was the general from the north, the newly conquered territories. That's not rigidity. That's a system in the throes of a potential evolution, or a schism.
Right. Pizarro didn't light the fire. He just poured gasoline on it. So if we take him out of the picture, let's say Atahualpa wins, which he was on the verge of doing, he's just captured Huascar. What does his empire look like? He was the battle-hardened, arguably more ruthless leader. Does the empire become even more militarized? Does the center of power shift from Cusco to Quito?
I think it has to. His power base was there. You might have seen Cusco become a kind of ceremonial, religious capital, while the true political and military power resided in the north. And that would have created this permanent tension, this duality that could have defined the empire for generations. Maybe it would have eventually split into two, a northern and southern empire, like Rome did.
Wow. An Andean Byzantium. And that, to me, feels like a more natural trajectory. It's a political evolution driven by internal forces, not a decapitation by a handful of outsiders. It feels like history, rather than a historical anomaly.
And it leaves you with this profound sense of loss, doesn't it? We're not just talking about the loss of life, which was catastrophic. We're talking about the loss of an entire answer to the question of how to organize a human civilization. Their system, with its emphasis on reciprocity and state security over individual wealth, it's a path not taken. We'll never know what it could have become.
Yeah. My final thought, though, is a little, I don't know, maybe a bit more skeptical. I wonder if a system so completely interwoven with a divine absolute monarch and so reliant on conquest for its cosmic and economic balance could ever have evolved into a peaceful, stable state. Without an external enemy to conquer or an internal rival to crush, does the justification for that absolute power start to fray? I think the encounter with an other, Any other, not necessarily Pizarro, was inevitable, and I'm not convinced the system had the flexibility to survive that kind of contact.
Maybe, or maybe, its definition of contact would have been completely different from ours, not as conquest, but as absorption. Another thread to be woven into the great tapestry. It's the ultimate historical what if, because the evidence itself was so thoroughly erased.
Erased. That's the word. We're left piecing together knotted strings, trying to read a story whose ending was torn out before it was ever written. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is, and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.